This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What if the end is not the end? That's likely the most oft-asked question in the depths of our hearts, especially when death claims someone dear to us, or when we stop to think of the years ticking by and we wonder how much time is left for us. And that question is at the heart of the latest book by Mitch Albom, The First Phone Call from Heaven. It tells the story of the town of Coldwater, Michigan. It's a fictional story. A handful of people begin receiving phone calls from people who have died. Are these phone calls from the afterlife or a big nasty hoax? Mitch Albom, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
I read The First Phone Call from Heaven, and I'll tell you, I did it in the context, Mitch, of having lost my mother-in-law earlier this year. So she was the last of our four parents to die. And although I can still hear their voices in my memory saying certain things in their own ways, boy, you know, what we would all give to really hear from those loved ones on the other side talking to us in real time. Where did this idea come for you?
Well, in its own weird way, it was a little similar to what you just said. My mother suffered a couple of major strokes about 3.5 years ago when I began to conceive this book, and they robbed her of the ability to speak. And I have not heard her voice since then. And it's been 3.5 years since she said a word to me.
Boy.
And, you know, I grew up with a very, very loquacious mother. So to all of a sudden have that voice stop was really very stunning. And while she's still alive, I can hold her hand, look at her. I'm not sure she knows if it's me or not. But to not hear that voice is to lose the essence of who she was. And I began to notice how people saved answering machine messages when people died, just to hear their voice saying, "Let's go to Costco tomorrow," or "I'll meet you at 8 at the restaurant," you know, little mundane sentences. It was the sound of the voice. And so I began to explore in the novel, well, what happens if I created a world where those voices were heard again, but they were from the other side, and they sort of validated that there was a heaven. How would that make people feel? And I sort of took off from there.
Mitch, you've said you hope that readers will take away from your book the idea that we are really missing something if we're not paying attention to those small miracles that happen all around us rather than seeking the one big, huge miracle. Tell us more about how you expand on that in your book.
Not to assume that anybody knows what the book is about. Right. It's a small town in northern Michigan. One day wakes up, the phones start ringing, people calling from heaven. Only it only happens to a handful of people, and it only happens in this small town. And the book follows what happens when the story leaks out to the rest of the country and the world, and people start descending on this little town in the middle of nowhere. They bring their phones. They all want to be part of this miracle. Everybody, you know, that's one reaction to a miracle, is everybody says, "Why not me?"
Yes.
And where's my share of it?
Sure.
Then the media gets involved with it, and they turn it into a big story. And meanwhile, there's sort of the protagonist of the book is this guy named Sully, who's kind of a broken man. He was in prison for something he didn't really do. His wife died while he was in prison, and he's got nothing good to think about the world. He has no belief in anything. And his 7-year-old son comes home one day from school with a toy phone, and he says, "Daddy, when is mommy going to call us?"
Boy.
And he realizes that the town has now infiltrated even his son's mind, and he sets out to prove that the whole thing is a hoax. And, of course, I use this character to basically be the voice of doubt in the book. As the miracle's getting bigger and bigger, he's digging deeper. He seems to be coming onto some clues as to what might be happening. And meanwhile, the thing gets so big that it's going to culminate with a planned for broadcast a few days before Christmas of the first actual live phone call from heaven, where the whole world is going to be listening in or watching on TV or watching on computers, and this call is scheduled to come, and they're going to hear a voice from the other side, just as it seems like he's sort of cracked the code as to what's going on.
Yeah.
So the idea of a miracle, as you ask me, was to explore, if you have a little miracle happen to you, is it your obligation to prove to the rest of the world that it's a miracle, or is it enough that it happened to you?
Hmm.
If I talk to somebody, as has happened many times in my life, because when you write the book Tuesdays with Maury, you're going to meet a lot of people who want to share grieving stories with you. And I've heard this story in some form. Oh, I was in my daughter's bedroom a year after she died. I was crying. I was sitting on her bed. I missed her so much. Suddenly, a photograph of the two of us fell off the bureau, and it landed by my feet. And I know that that was her. She was sending me a sign that we were okay. She was sending me a sign. I know it was her. Now, I could bring in 10 physicists who could explain why a picture falls off a bureau at a particular time, some vibration of the earth, whatever it is. Won't matter.
Mm-mm.
To that woman, that's what it was. That was the miracle. And who's to say she's wrong?
You're right.
That's my point. You know, if it's a miracle to her, it's a miracle. That's a good enough reason.
Boy, in effect, as you say that, I had that very thing happen with my late father's fire helmet. He was a fire captain in Ferndale. And mm-hmm. I know exactly what you're talking about. We were all standing around. It was up on top of a bookcase. Nobody bumped the bookcase, and suddenly it came down, boom. And someone said, he's letting you know he's there. And you're right. I'm not going to challenge that. I'm accepting that miracle. And it seems that that has certainly been something you've realized in your life.
Well, I happen to be a person who unashamedly believes in small miracles every day. Mm-hmm. I am overwhelmed and in a constant state of amazement at the gift of life and the various forms that it takes. I've been blessed to see a lot of the world and conditions in parts of the world where you couldn't even believe that someone could ever smile again, and yet see people smiling and see children happy. I've had experiences happen to me that I should have been dead and walked away from. I've had fortune come my way in Tuesdays with Maury, the book, to see my professor on television one night and happen to just flip the channel and happen to write a book that I can't just explain away by coincidence or luck. It feels to me like something much bigger is at play in the universe, and I believe that that manifests itself in people's lives many different times. There's a paragraph in the book that says, you know, miracles happen every day. The appearance of a person at an accident scene all of a sudden, someone who happens to sail by when someone falls off a boat,
mm-hmm.
all these kinds of things that we just say, boy, wasn't that lucky? Well, was it lucky or was it, you know, somebody watching out for us? And so I have no problem writing books about little miracles that happen. I've written them a couple times now.
Yes.
And it's how I feel my life is gone.
Would you read us an excerpt, maybe your favorite excerpt from the first Fallen Call from Heaven?
Well, I'll read you the first page because it sort of sets the tone of the book. It begins with the chapter heading, The Week It Happened. On the day the world received its first phone call from heaven, Tess Rafferty was unwrapping a box of tea bags. Ring. She ignored the ring and dug her nails into the plastic. Ring. She clawed her forefinger through the bumpy part on the side. Ring. Finally, she made a rip, then peeled off the wrapping and scrunched it in her palm. She knew the phone would go to answering machine if she didn't grab it before one more ring. Hello. Too late. Ah, this thing, she mumbled. She heard the machine click on her counter as it played her outgoing message. Hi, it's Tess. Leave your name and number. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. A small beep sounded. Tess heard static. And then, it's Mom. I need to tell you something. Tess stopped breathing. The receiver fell from her fingers. Her mother died 4 years ago.
That's Mitch Albom reading the opening words from his newest novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. So it begins with phone calls like these coming to just a few people in this town, and word quickly spreads. You show us people who really want to believe these calls come from heaven. They're out praying in public, praying on lawns, hoping for their own calls. And then you show us those who really do not believe. They're out protesting. They're calling out the chosen few and saying they're manipulators and liars. It seems you've put your finger directly on both sides of a question that humans have wrestled with since we first walked the earth.
Well, I like to explore the idea of if heaven really was proven, at least in some people's minds, how would it change people's behavior? Because this is the great mystery, as you said, this is the question that people have asked since the dawn of time. What comes next? If you really honestly had some proof, how would that change your behavior? And this is what I explore, as you point out, sometimes people come and protest because they don't want to believe that there really could be something next, because then they might have to change their ways. And some of the people in the book do exactly that. They start straightening up their act. They start going to church more often. They start asking for forgiveness. They start planning for the other side. Some people who have terminal illnesses no longer battle them the same way that they did because they feel, all right, this is just a passage now. It's not giving up of everything. Think about how people would really change their behavior if they truly accepted that there was someplace else. And, of course, the very religious amongst us who believe this fervently in their heart, and also some people who have had those near-death experiences where they've come back, they do have an interesting calm about them. If you've spent time with them or talked to them, they do have this sort of, I'm not all that worried about the things that everybody else is worried about. And I'm kind of fascinated by that. And so I tried to explore it from both sides.
You know, I have to ask you to talk a little more about something you referenced, and that was the media madness, and, you know, starting with the local TV reporter hauling her own camera, looking for that big story to get her to the major market, and then it blows up to the network media circus, and boy, was it relatable as it spilled out, and oh, we're going to have that big live broadcast and the big story. And, you know, you look at that carnival, and I guess you and I can both say over the years we have probably we've played a role in that. Do you ever see this cycle of media madness abating where the public may say, you know, enough already? We know we're being played.
Boy, I wish the public would be that smart. I worry for the future of this business that I and you have chosen. You're right. I'm very cynical in this book about the media's handling of this. And sadly, I think I'm also accurate. I think if a story like this broke, where a town claimed to be getting phone calls from heaven and there seemed to be something to it, this is exactly what would happen.
Absolutely.
TV stations would descend on it. Everybody would kind of fan out and try to find their particular person and guard them from anyone else talking to them. There'd be all kinds of exclusives. There'd be interviews with experts decrying it or trying to prove it. There'd be people hanging around outside the porches of these people's houses. And nobody would seek any perspective.
No.
They would just want to milk it for as long as it goes. And at one point, probably the most sort of hard-edged or sarcastic moment in the book with regard to the media comes when they're about to do this broadcast of this live phone call from heaven. And the night before, the mayor of this small town starts to worry about what if it doesn't come. All these people, now there's thousands of people in the town and there's cameras everywhere and the whole world is watching. And he says to the producer of this TV special, what if the call doesn't come? And the producer just rolls his eyes and said, what does that matter? And the mayor can't understand, you know, what do you mean, what does it matter? Isn't that the whole point? And basically the producer says, it doesn't matter if the call comes or not, as long as they keep watching. You know, and that's sort of the truth of what sadly our business has become at its worst, which is we really don't care if we're reporting the truth. We really don't care if we have any perspective on anything. We really don't care if we're being fair to people, as long as we're bringing people in under the tent.
I'm talking with Mitch Albom about his new novel, The First Phone Call from Heaven. And, you know, Mitch, in your acknowledgement at the end of The First Phone Call from Heaven, you write, and I'll quote here, this book was written with God's grace, lots of coffee, a morning table by a Michigan window, and love from family and friends. It was birthed at a difficult time, and many people helped me through that. I was wondering, can you share anything about what was going on for you, and did writing this book help you out?
It's sort of personal, so I can't, unfortunately, tell you a lot of details of that. But yes, I can say that the writing of this book, which took place every morning, my routine of writing is very predictable. It's the first thing I do every morning. I get up, have a cup of coffee. My wife is usually up ahead of me. We sit down, say a few prayers, talk for a couple minutes, and then I go downstairs. There's no phone calls. There's no newspapers. There's no radio. There's no input of any kind. The first time I turn my brain on is to try to create the sentences for my books. And during this difficult time, it was an absolute refuge for me. And I would sometimes hide and stay down there for hours, just not wanting to stop writing, because stopping writing meant that I had to deal with the rest of the world and the things that I was dealing with. And so this book, more than anything that I've written, traversed that period of time and became a sanctuary. And I really realized how deeply in love I am with the craft of writing, not just because I like the physical act of it or I like reading in the end what you produce, but because it's a safe place for me. It became a place that I built around myself and then crawled inside, and it's never quite been like that before. So I have a revitalized passion for writing because of what it provided for me during this tough time, which, by the way, has ended.
Okay.
They're finally now all behind me, and we've come through them. But, I hope you respect the fact
absolutely.
That I don't want to go into the details of them.
You know, as you're out doing book signings and making appearances for the first phone call from heaven, what are you hearing from people? What do you think they're hoping to find when they seek out this story?
Almost always it's, I wish I could have a phone call like this. In fact, sometimes they ask me to write that inside the book to, you know, Lenny, your phone call is coming. To Genevieve, wait one day, you'll hear from Larry, you know.
Yeah.
To Larry, you know, never forget Genevieve, you know, you might get a phone call one day. Even though, obviously, the conceit of a phone call is almost feels, you know, a little corny. They're not talking about a phone call. They're talking about seeing them again or hearing from them again.
Let me know and you're there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. As even you mentioned during our interview, and it doesn't surprise me because I've become acutely aware ever since writing Tuesdays with Maury, and that now is 17 years, how much grieving goes on, how much yearning and longing for lost loved ones goes on every single day inside of people who are working right alongside you, who are eating at the subway right next to you, who are walking into the movie theater right next to you, who you might assume, well, they look like they're just going about life. They don't look like they're in pain. They don't look like they're missing anything. Peel that onion. Get into one of these conversations. And with me, they happen pretty quickly because people relate to me that way.
Yeah.
And you will be astonished at how many people go through life every day wishing that they could hear from someone else again or missing someone so much that they're crying on the inside even as they're taking your order behind the counter or filing a report or standing in a courtroom or whatever the case may be. It is just such a common human emotion, and I see it when people get this book. The title of this book alone has people picking it up and embracing it because of what they want in their own lives.
The book is The First Phone Call from Heaven, the latest novel by Mitch Albom. And Mitch is making appearances, a series of them, to support the book. And you can go to MitchAlbom.com and get the schedule and find out about all his charities and all of his other work. And Mitch, it's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking so much time with me. And I look forward to doing it again.